Brown v. Commissioner of Internal Revenue. Ms. Anfinson. Yes, go ahead.
May it please the court. I'm Carol Anfinson, but I actually am representing my husband, Bruce Brown, today, and under my married name, I'm Carol Anfinson Brown. And I am, of course, an attorney, and so is my husband. This case, of course, involves a tax court appeal, and so it involves Internal Revenue Code. The case involves the cancellation of my husband's life insurance policy, in which the premiums for most of the years were paid by a premium loan. What it was is my husband in the early 80s bought a life insurance policy from Northwestern Mutual Life Insurance Company, and he paid high premiums for about 5 years, and then after that, the premiums were paid by dividends, because Northwestern Mutual is a mutual insurance company which pays dividends, and that's how it was represented to him when he purchased the policy. But in his particular case, rather than the premiums directly paying, rather than the dividends directly paying the premiums, there was a little, unless you signed this little form, which he didn't do, instead it purchased, the dividends purchased additional paid-up insurance, which meant we had more insurance.
But, and, you know, I want to jump straight to one of your other arguments, because, you know, a lot of that's rehearsed in the tax court's opinion. You seem to think there's some huge significance to subpart E4 section of this. And I look at E5 to begin with, which is the retention of existing rules in certain cases, and that's the part for insurance, you know, early distributions. And it begins by saying paragraph 2B shall not apply, also 4A. And then you go to 4, and it's the whole thing is about special rules for application of paragraph 2B. So I am at a loss to see how paragraph 4 has anything to do with your case.
Okay, I'll tell you.
I don't want to look at that. I mean,
okay,
we have right
but I'll tell you that. I'll look at my chart.
You can look at your chart.
Here's the problem. Okay, for one thing, it isn't special rules. It really is, the judge cited the wrong part. That's above.
I am just looking at the Internal Revenue Code, Title 26, Section 72E, amounts not received as annuities. And then we have various things.
Right.
And you get to E5.
Okay. That one is paragraph 5. It's hard to read, but each one of those numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, is a paragraph.
It's not that hard to read. Why do you say that?
Because it keeps talking about paragraphs and it's not actually labeled as a paragraph. And so sometimes you wonder where you are. Okay, the number 5 is retention of existing rules in certain cases. It's not special. I have it actually on my chart. I copied it right from it. And then it talks about, if you look down at C, it seems to relate to life insurance policies. And then it, when you go back up to A, it talks about certain things should not apply. And it seems to knock out 4B, which is our exception. And
well,
our
it knocks out paragraph 2B altogether. And since the topic of paragraph E4 is special rules for application of paragraph 2B, that's where I
understand
that E4
what you're saying, Your Honor.
Isn't about your situation.
Okay, but what you've missed is 5B. And the IRS and the judge did not see 5B.
I don't see why 5B is.
Because it talks about TEFRA. TEFRA was in 1982, and see what it says.
This paragraph shall apply to contracts entered into before August 14, 1982, any amount allocable to investment in the contract after that amount shall be treated as from a contract entered in after such date.
Right. And we fit the second one. While we entered into the contract before that date, it says any amounts allocable to investment. And what's allocable to investment? It's actually the dividends, because that went in the investment eventually. Because the dividends paid up additional insurance, and when it was surrendered, it paid this premium loan. And when you look at what the exception is, it's dividends that pay the premium loan, which aren't taxed. And I know what you're saying about two.
Quite persuaded by the tax court's notion that Mr. Brown paid $44,205 in premiums, $11,999 by check, $28,532 by these premium loans, $3,674 by dividends. That's the total premiums paid.
Yes.
Right? And he got some distributions. He took distributions of $31,063 when he decided to surrender the paid-up additional insurance. He took
It went to pay the premium loan. That's the paid-up additional insurance. Went down to pay the premium loan.
So what? It's a loan.
Yes, but the exception is for premiums that pay the dividends, and it's premiums or other consideration. And so it's not just premiums. The other consideration, of course, is the paid-up additional insurance. Plus, Northwestern itself.
That doesn't make any sense, though. It means you can take out this loan and, you know.
Okay, can I go back to the original? When we got the 1099, it actually said loans repaid at surrender. And the way it works, loan is repaid at surrender. What it is that you have a cash value in these policies. And when the loan got up to...
You could back up and explain how this insurance works. So you buy the insurance and you're making monthly or annual premiums.
Yes, large ones actually, yes.
Now, as the years pass, of course you're paying the premiums, how is cash value created?
Okay, it's actually defined in the policy. It's by the table of, well, they have a table that has cash value, and of course what it really is, and it's plus dividends and paid-up insurance. Okay, paid-up additional insurance. So cash value is actually going to be your dividends, and the paid-up insurance is really purchased by your dividends. And this table, and the table goes up the more how much you pay for it. And so originally it's higher than your original amount when you pay your first $1,000, but then it becomes more even. It's actually something that you have purchased. Table of guaranteed values is what they actually call it, and it's defined in the policy, Your Honor.
And the cash value is what you get if you give up the insurance?
No, it's how much you can borrow on the policy.
How much you can borrow, that's all the significance
yes,
of cash value.
Yes, right.
So the years pass, you're paying these premiums, and as you pay the premiums, your borrowing ability increases. Is that right? Because you say your cash value is...
Yes, it would. Yes, it actually does.
Okay,
yeah.
So you borrow money against your policy, and in addition, so you're borrowing, but you're also getting dividends because
right. They're
investing your premiums.
Yes.
They're earning interest, and they're giving you some of it.
Well, yes. I don't know that the premiums are... I don't know if they're earning interest, but whatever. But essentially, that's what it is.
Dividends. And then when you decide to give up the policy, then the dividends are used to pay the premiums you owe. Is that how
well?
It works?
It's actually the debt. I mean, what they call the loan. See, they have an automatic premium loan. The dividends don't directly go to pay the premium.
You've been
they
borrowing
have this loan
money,
goes
so
to
you
pay
owe
the
money. So you borrowed money, you owe the money. When you give up the insurance, instead of repaying the loan, the dividends are assigned to repay the loan.
It's actually the cash value, which is dividends and a table of guaranteed value. Yes. See, when they get equal...
So the cash value is used to repay the loans.
Well, yes. Yes. And so we
which is what makes your investment in the contract only the difference between what you put in, however you put it in, whether it's the premium loans or not, and what you've taken out, which is where you wound up with this $8,271.
$8,200 is actually the amount of premiums that we paid. It didn't give us credit for the rest of it. That's what the problem is. The $8,000 is what we paid. The amount of the premium loan and the cash value were both about
$29,000. Well, they say you paid $44,205.
Oh, that includes all the dividends.
They said that you got distributions of almost thirty-six. And so you wind up with an investment in the contract of the $8,000. I mean, you want that to be as small a number as possible because that's the number you didn't pay taxes on.
Well, it's $29,000 is what they said we didn't pay taxes, not $8,000. $8,000 is how much we actually paid in when my husband wrote a check to them in the first 5 years.
Well, your investment in the contract was the $8,000.
That's right. That's how much we actually paid by check to Metropolitan. Or Northwestern, I'm sorry, Northwestern Mutual. Okay, but and when you
run through that again, the when the policy was canceled, you you repaid.
So he receives in effect the $37,365, most of which goes to retire the premium loan debt. Right.
Yes, he did when he surrendered. That's, I think, approximately the amount that he got when he surrendered the paid-up addition.
And that exceeds his investment in the contract.
Exceeds it. No, it didn't
what,
exceed
what the
it.
Tax court says is Mr. Brown had gross income of $29,000 and some, which is the amount by which the $37,365 he received exceeded his $8,000.
That's how they
that's
arrived
page
at it.
17.
Yes,
of the
I know.
Tax
that's the formula that's prescribed.
Opinion.
So that and that $37,000 represented cash value or dividends, or that was what.
Right.
That was your share of your and your husband's share of the earnings from. The insurance company's
cash value was more around $29,000, Your Honor, not the $37,000, because right. They were probably from $29,000 to $37,000 would be the extra $8,000 that we had paid. But there's a formula, but they didn't give us credit for the dividends that had been, because all they gave us credit for when they subtracted the $8,000 was the amount that we had actually paid in. But I would like to tell you the reason.
I thought that was the dividends were part of that, though.
No, not the eight.
Premium loans and the dividends. And the distributions are three different dividend distributions, 2004, 2000.
Oh, there were a couple of dividends distributions.
Yeah.
They were a little over $1,000 in 2004 and 5. They were
almost
a little over
3,000 in 2004, 31 also in 2004 when you surrendered the paid-up insurance, and about a little less than 2,000
right.
in 2005.
Right, because we did the pay.
So the dividends are in the equation.
In the top number, yes.
Well, that $29,000 represents the earnings from the investment of premiums, isn't it? Your earnings from what the insurance company did with the premiums?
Yes.
Well, isn't that income? As an original matter, abstracting from the intricacies of the Internal Revenue Code, isn't that income that would ordinarily be taxable?
Yes, Your Honor, but it's forgiveness of debt.
So you're appealing to some special exception.
And a little bit more. We feel that we gave up something, the cash value, and, okay, we gave up the cash value, which was exactly equal to the debt, or actually the debt had gone over by a couple hundred dollars. And I want to draw your attention to the field service advisory that we originally found. See, when we got the 1099, what it said on it is loans repaid at surrender. They explained on our 1099, it says loans repaid at surrender. Okay, we surrendered our cash value and it paid the loan. So we gave up our cash value, which was equal to the loan. And so therefore, we didn't feel it was a taxable event.
But your cash value had been created by the dividends, or forget, you don't have to talk about it. The cash value had been created by the fact that your money had been put to work by the insurance company,
sure,
and
of
it
course.
Yielded
yes.
this benefit.
Yes.
Now, of course, you did presumably give up the insurance too, right? The
$100,000. Well, yes. We didn't have any insurance.
Give up something, yeah.
Right. Okay, and so therefore, when we originally got it, loans loans repaid at surrender written right on the 1099, we viewed it as the loan was approximately $29,000, the cash value was $29,000, so it was a wash. And I realized why they were saying okay, because it can be taxable when they cancel indebtedness, because you know you get a benefit and that's considered income. But in our case, we didn't feel it was cancellation of indebtedness because we had given up something of equal value. And we found...
Now, where do you point to in the Internal Revenue Code for the conclusion that this is not taxable? Is that when
well,
we're back
cancellation
in
this, of indebtedness
is 3B again, or 4B rather?
4B is one. But also that we've given up something equal, and you look at what the interpretations are. For instance, the field service advisor, which was the first thing we found, it talks about whether the subsequent cancellation of the policies resulted in a taxable event to the taxpayer.
Hasn't the IRS disavowed that, though, and said that that's not an authoritative source?
That's correct, Your Honor, but however... anything that is a reasonable interpretation of the statute is an authoritative source.
Well, actually, they say no. Those things which are seen to be authoritative are authoritative sources. You wouldn't do it on a law review article.
That's not actually right in their quote. Also, they said that a treatise isn't. Well, the conclusions, if you really read the statute and the regulations, they left out when they quoted it, but the statute's at the end of their brief, that the authoritative sources, while the conclusion of a treatise is not an authoritative source, that the underlying authorities are, and also always the well-reasoned explanation of it is authority. Plus, you have to remember, at this particular time, it's not what we knew, it's what was actually out there for the law at the time. There weren't any cases completely on point. Atwood was someone who borrowed a personal loan. Our policy distinguishes a personal loan, what they call a policy loan, from a... This is an automatic premium loan, Your Honor. It automatically goes into effect if your dividends are going to purchase additional. So the policy itself distinguished a premium loan from a policy loan. Okay, and the only cases on point at that time were the series of cases like Atwood where they borrowed against their policy for personal reasons. Mr. Atwood was having financial difficulties. Remember, we never borrowed against this policy. It was this automatic premium loan, which is something different in the Northwestern. So the fact that their own policy has a different, Northwestern's own calculations call these premiums. And what I wanted to point out to you is they automatically go that the retention of existing rules knocks out 4B, and it doesn't. If you look at 5B, they forget B. It talks about after 1982, and that fits ours. Any amounts allocable to investment in a contract after August 13, 1982 shall be treated as from a contract entered into after that date. And amount allocable to investment are all our dividends. And so, therefore, their C in knocking out 4, which is our special that treatments of policyholder dividends that are used to pay premiums are not included in gross income. So they do not knock out our exception if you look down at B.
You'll have to end.
Thank you very much. I think I made my point.
Give you a minute after we hear from Ms. Milton.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Ms. Anfinson. Ms. Milton?
May it please the Court, my name is Terry Milton, representing the Commissioner. I'm not quite sure where to start here. I hope we laid it out pretty clearly in our brief how the statutory scheme applies to the facts of this case. And I think it's been a little bit...
What is the specific statutory provision on which you rely? Is that 5A?
Yes, sir.
5A and B?
Yes, sir.
5A, B, and C?
5A and 5A and C, which makes 5A, which makes Section 72E5 apply to life.
Looking at 5A, I'm puzzled. 5A 2 says if paragraph 2A does not apply... Where's paragraph 2A? I don't see that.
It's paragraph 72E2A, which relates to non-annuity distributions.
That's what it's referred. Why does it call it 2A if it's actually E?
Well, there is no...
So it's this provision that says if received on or after the annuity starting date?
Yes, sir.
That's the provision that does apply.
Well, that's what is being referred to in 5A2. It doesn't apply in this case because...
It does not apply.
This distribution took place before the annuity starting date. But that reference in 72E...
So 5 is your... is what you're relying on.
Yes, sir.
5. Which is there some logic behind 5, or is this entirely arbitrary? Is there some reason why there is tax liability under 5?
There would be tax liability. There is tax liability because there's income in an annuity contract over time. It builds up some value in addition to what you put into it, and that income is taxable.
What about the fact that when the Browns or Mr. Brown gave up his insurance and received the $37,000, he was giving up the insurance. That has value.
It does have value.
It's not really a net of $37,000.
No, it wasn't.
37 minus 8, right?
That was the value.
Is
yes,
the notion that the $8,000 is the value of the $100,000 insurance policy? Is that the notion?
No, Your Honor. The value is the $37,000. $8,000 is what they had paid to acquire that value. So the difference between the $8,000 and the
$37,000.
Pardon me?
Had paid to acquire the $37,000?
Yes, sir. And the difference...
But what about the value of the insurance policy? aren't they, in effect, selling the insurance policy back to the insurance company? The insurance company had this contingent liability of $100,000 to him. Now he's given that up. I mean, it's true he's gotten $37,000, but he's sold... It doesn't look as if $37,000 or $29,000 is net, because that's the gross receipt for the sale of his insurance back to the insurance company.
I'm not sure I'm able to conceptualize it quite that way.
No, wait. It's a very, very simple point. The insurance policy created a liability of the insurance company to Brown. It's contingent. Maybe he'll live forever. We'll never have to pay. But it is a liability. And that liability is wiped out when the insurance policy is canceled. So while it's true that they received the net of $29,000, that's net of their cost, but they're net of that $8,000 cost, but they've also given up this asset, the insurance policy itself.
Well, Your Honor...
It has some value. Shouldn't that value be subtracted in deciding what their income is from this transaction?
Your Honor, I would suggest that the significance of the face value of the insurance policy may have some tax implications for the insurance company when it's relieved of that liability. But from the taxpayer's perspective, what it is that they've made an investment in an asset, which is this insurance policy, and they've put in $8,000, and over time it has become worth, in terms of what they can take out of it, $37,000. Therefore, they have made a gain of about $29,000.
They've also lost an asset, namely the insurance policy.
But that asset isn't worth $100,000 to them unless Mr. Brown dies.
No, it's not worth $100,000, but it has some value, depending on his age, his health, and so on. Suppose he were very old. He had a fatal disease, right? Then he could actually sell his insurance policy, right? They do that. Or you borrow against it. Right, so it's a real asset which he gave up. And shouldn't that be, shouldn't the value of that asset to him, whatever it was, contingent asset has some value, shouldn't that be subtracted in deciding what he actually obtained by giving up the policy?
I'm going to resort to the statutory scheme and say that it does not contemplate any calculation of that kind of a contingent value to the taxpayers. It would be worth $100,000 to them if Mr. Brown died. It is only worth $37,000 to them if they want to take the money, if they want to take what they've got in it back out again. That's
no, they clearly thought that the $29,000, I mean, if they're thinking straight, the $29,000 is more than this contingent asset, the insurance policy. It's just probably not, it's not $29,000 more because it has some value. But this hasn't been discussed in the cases, has it?
No, sir. I would like to go back and make one point that I think is being lost sight of here, which is that in all this talk about the applicability of 72E4B, which has to do with dividends that are used to make premium payments, number one, we have contended that Section 72E4B doesn't apply here because it's a special rule that applies for purposes of a statute that expressly is not applicable under 72E5. But more to the point, this is not what happened in this case. The dividends that were paid on this policy were not used to pay premiums. They were used to buy additional insurance. And what the taxpayers did in this case, or what Mr. Brown did in this case, was to take premium loans every year after 1986 up until 2004. He wasn't paying any premiums, but the insurance company was continuing to keep him covered because they were loaning him money. So at some point, he had his loans outpaced his contributions to the contract, and they called him on it. And so he surrendered the paid-up additional insurance, which is what he had bought with his dividends. That amount of money was used to pay off loans. The taxpayers would have it that there's no difference in this situation, that dividends bought paid-up insurance.
So how much had his insurance grown to?
I believe it was $37,000 by the time of the cancellation.
So instead of having $100,000, he had $137,000. Is that how it works?
Well, prior to the surrender of insurance in 2004, he had paid up additional insurance, but that would have increased the $100,000 face value.
I know. To what did it increase it?
It's not in the record, and I don't know. But
so are you saying that what he gave up? So the dividends had been used to buy additional insurance? Is that the idea?
Yes. Until 2004, at the same time he was getting dividends, he could have used the dividends to pay the premiums, but he didn't elect to do that. That was a policy option, but he didn't elect it.
To buy more insurance.
Buy more, and at the same time he was borrowing from the insurance company at 8%. And
so he gets this $31,063 amount from the 2004 surrender of the paid-up additional insurance.
Yes, Your Honor.
Right. So it may or may not have had some face value of an extra $31,000 and some, but he surrenders
that's right.
That
by the
much.
Cancellation of the policy, he didn't have any additional paid-up because
by that time he's back down to the
that's right. And that money was used to pay off the debt. But the point is, it was debt. If he had died in say 2004, he was covered. Even though he wasn't paying premiums, he was borrowing from the insurance company for his premiums. After 1986, he didn't pay any premiums out of his own pocket. He was actually borrowing, and the insurance company was extending credit to him by continuing his policy in force, even though he wasn't paying premiums.
But your position is he also, by the same token, is accruing a debt at 8% interest a year that he or his estate or somebody would owe.
That's correct. That would have been paid out of the payout of $100,000 if he had died while the policy was still in effect. So
let me see if I understand. It's very complicated. So he's getting dividends, and he's using dividends to get more insurance, right?
Yes, sir.
And at the same time, of course, he owes premiums, but he's borrowing money to pay the premiums.
Yes, sir.
From the insurance company.
So he is paying premiums.
And they gave
borrowing after 1986.
That's a different transaction.
Yes. But he's paying the premiums. The policy stays in effect up until 2005. Yeah. Yes, the premiums are paid.
So there is a premium being paid.
Yes,
through a loan.
Yes,
transaction.
Yes, sir. That's why the total premiums paid is $44,200 something, even though their cash premium payment is more like $8,000.
So when the loans are no longer when the loans are no longer adequate to pay the premiums, then the company is saying to him, "You have to pay more, or we're going to cancel the policy." Is that how it works?
Well, actually, what happened is that the loans had exceeded the cash value. Like, the insurance company was secured up as long as they had a cash value in the policy that was greater than the amount that the taxpayers had borrowed, they were secured. If the policy terminated, they were going to keep the cash value to satisfy the loans. But at some point, the amount of the loans exceeded the cash value, and at that point, they contacted the taxpayers.
They tell him he has to repay some of the loans or else the policy is canceled. At that point, he decides, accepts the cancellation, and the $29,000 is the cash value minus what? What's the $8,000 again?
The $29,000 is the difference between the $37,000 cash value and the $8,000 investment in the contract. That's what the $29,000 is.
The contract means what?
The cash they've actually paid. The rest they borrowed and had to pay back.
So this is the premiums that they paid directly rather than through borrowing. Is that it? The $8,000?
It would also include, in 2004 and 2005, their dividends were used to pay premiums. So it didn't come; they didn't write checks for it, but it was additional premium payments.
So those premiums
that were not borrowed. The 2004 and 2005 premiums were paid not by means of a loan, is what I mean to say. So yes, the $29,000 is the difference between the cash value of the policy and their actual cash investment in one manner or another, check writing, dividend.
So the cash value is what, in effect, they earned because the insurance company was investing the premiums. And
yes, Your Honor, and that is why.
As they get a piece of that.
And that is why they have been held to have had income in that amount in the year that the insurance policy terminated. The only other point I wanted to make was...
The point is that specified in 5, in paragraph 5.
Yes, sir. That's the amount that they received in excess of their investments.
E2A is not applicable. Is that...
Neither E2A nor E2B is applicable because this is a life insurance contract and it's covered by E5 instead, which just dictates that the amount they receive in excess of their investment counts as income to them. The only other thing I wanted to say was that the field service advice that Ms. Anfinson referred to is not an authoritative source, and no source that they have relied on, either that or the treatise that they cite, which is a tax management portfolio, I think, neither of those is recognized by Treasury regulations as authority for a position so as to insulate you from penalty. The only things that are recognized are either congressional pronouncements or government publications.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Milton. And Ms. Anfinson, your time expired. We'll give you one minute, but it'll have to be just a minute because we're running.
Your Honor, they keep saying we didn't have any authority, substantial authority, but the point is that just plain didn't exist. The only cases were these ones where people borrow personally. And the only authority is an interpretation of the tax code itself. Like I said, so there wasn't any. So how could our substantial authority was actually the BNA article, which it's a treatise, then you can't use the conclusion of the treatise, but you can use the underlying authority. So we did have authority. There wasn't any other authority existed. And so we had the substantial, or we didn't have it. It existed. And that's what it is. It doesn't matter whether we knew about it. And as far as the IRS publication, of course, that we had where it's an even exchange, that it says right at the end of it. It isn't can't be used as authority. But you can use the reasoning of it, and that's what existed, is whether we had a well-reasoned concept of this. And I think that we did.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Milton.